All right, guys, Mark here with today's bonus episode featuring my chat with Rachel Paris, who will be performing at the Oranmore in Glasgow on Wednesday, the 1st of May. Rachel, you probably know from the BBC's MASH report and the viral videos which came out from that. We talk about Rachel's experience on that show, becoming a viral sensation and ending up on every telly show going subsequently, and what that experience was like from her perspective. We also talk about when Rachel went on to host the version of the show that ended up on Dave called Late Night MASH, and what that was like to do at the exact same time as Liz Truss became the Prime Minister and the Queen died. So loads of really interesting stuff there. We also talk a wee bit about Rachel's previous experiences of gigging in Scotland. We chat about the difference between what an audience knows you for versus what to expect from your solo show, and loads of other great stuff. Rachel was really lovely, had a great time chatting with her. And we also talk about the fact that she was the judge when Stephen Buchanan won the BBC New Comedy Award in 2018. And and you'll be delighted to hear what she now knows him for. No prizes for guessing what it might be, starting with WH and ending with a Smith. But aside from that, guys, we hope you enjoy today's episode with Rachel Paris. You're going to be in Glasgow on the 1st of May doing Oranmore.
That's right.
And it's described in the press thing that they make us read as a love letter to musical comedy, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not about musical comedy. It's just got lots of musical comedy in it. I feel like I'm doing more. So I'm kind of being a bit more upfront about, guys, I know everyone takes the make out of musical comedy, but I am a musical comedian, so get ready for songs. But it's about half and half. It's about half songs, half stand-up.
And that's kind of like what you done when you started out stand-up, certainly, isn't it? Because I've just finished what I was watching, that the I'm Amazing song, the kind of X Factor parody thing.
Yeah, oh my God, that was years ago. Yeah, that was one of the first songs that I wrote that I really kind of gigged and that people really liked. And I can't do it anymore because it was a piss take of like that X Factor song.
Yeah.
That, like, it was really more of a 2010, 2012 kind of phenomenon. The self-aggrandizing song about finding yourself and reaching your goal and being a star. And they don't really do that anymore, do they, on the X Factor? No. So I've had to retire that one.
That's it. I suppose nowadays it's just everybody is that X Factor star just on TikTok or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Love yourself. Self-care. Yeah.
And so you're coming to Glasgow. Can I ask? I would like to be interested to hear have you played Glasgow before, like, much?
Yeah. I played Glasgow the last two tours, but I've also done, like, I played the Oranmore twice before. Yeah. And I've been to Glasgow quite a lot, like played little venues, I've done like the sort of Glasgow Comedy Festival, and also been, my friend got married there.
So where did they get married, do you remember?
It was a Catholic church, quite central.
You split the audience here, by the way.
Oh no. I think it might have been called St Andrews. But and then, yeah, had the reception in like a big town hall, like a civic hall or something.
Yeah.
Anyway. It was great. But yeah, I love Glasgow.
Do you find the crowds any different here? Do you find them more up for it, more mental? Or are they generally being kind of... I suppose the thing is, like, when you're doing a tour, it's like, it's kind of your crowd, isn't it? So you generally find if they're quite nice everywhere, they'll be nice.
Yeah, yeah, you know, that's there. It. Like, I feel like when you're doing places like comedy clubs, like The Stand, or like, you know, more kind of like places where they haven't come to see you, you just happen to be on the bill, then you get more of a sense of like what that crowd is like. But I mean, even then, I've never had any trouble. I don't know if it's like what I do on stage, but I don't generally tend to have like a lot of aggro or heckles or anything like that. It might be because I've got a bit of a teacher vibe going on.
Yes.
But especially on tour, I've just always had a nice time in Glasgow. Like, I think, like you say, it's sort of a self-selecting audience. Like, if you like what I do, then you buy tickets to my show. So you're probably not someone who's going to pick an argument in the middle of the show, but you never know. I've had walkouts, not in Glasgow, but I've had walkouts, people who definitely didn't know what they were going to come to. And when I started calling Boris Johnson a cunt, they walked out. And I was like, if that surprises you, then you definitely didn't know who you were seeing.
You're not going to get many walkouts in Glasgow if you say that, though, I would
No,
say.
Hopefully my references are a bit more updated now. There's many more conservative MPs that I can call that now. But...
There was a bit of graffiti in Glasgow, and it said Boris Johnson is a pure fanny or something like that. And then it got, so they sort of got rid of it, and then someone else put Boris Johnson is still a pure fanny.
I really like that.
It's interesting you say about like you've not had any sort of hassle with audiences, because I think that there is something you've done before in a show that I would sort of worry about. Hassle coming from it, because when you've done the Advice from Strangers thing, they ended up as your book. So what you were doing, from what I understand, is you were just asking your audiences on tour to kind of like write wee bits of advice for you to then read out on in the show or whatever. I would worry, if I'd done that, I'd be like worried that they'd all be going, write some better jokes. Like, do you know what
oh
I mean?
There was a bit, do you know what, there was a few, one of them that actually more than one said maybe don't be late for your own stand-up show, because
Whoa.
I had missed a train and I was like, in the end, only like 5 minutes, but like 5 minutes late starting. And they all saw me, because at the time it was a tiny little like 80 seater theater. So they saw me arrive like at the time when the show was meant to start. So I got a lot of people, their advice was like, try and be on time.
I suppose as well, like if the train was late, I mean, essentially, and they're digging you up a bit, you just use that as a callback to why Boris Johnson's such a cunt, because it's really their fault that the trains weren't running in time anyway.
Yeah,
so.
I should have said that as part of the show. I didn't think of it at the time.
And so you obviously ended up doing that as your book, but you would take some of the stuff that people would advise you, and sometimes you'd kind of go away, and other times you'd sort of rail against it.
Yeah. So like some of it was just great, solid advice, like never eat yellow snow. Have a wee whenever you've got the opportunity, like just solid
Those
advice.
Those sort of tie into each other as well,
don't they?
They?
I just realised I've just picked two wee-based ones for some reason. It's obviously what sticks in my mind. Other bits of it, were bits that I don't agree with or that are annoying. Kind of, I didn't love the ones that were a bit live, laugh, love, that kind of thing. Even be kind. Is one that the chapter in my book was kind of dedicated to railing against, not the idea of kindness and being kind, but people saying be kind online is often an incredibly irritating and simplistic response to a massive issue, or just saying like it actually can be quite an aggressive thing to say to someone, be kind, please. Like, we live in a, well, I say this in the book, but like we live in a world where, you know, you can, people like Jacob Rees-Mogg pride themselves on being polite at all times and being well-meaning and being what he said. I remember when he was asked once about abortion, whether he approves of abortion, even in the case of rape. And he was like, I'm afraid so. Yes, I'm afraid so. And it's like, you can be polite, but what you're doing is an absolute moral affront. And so I just think that kindness is completely subjective. And lots of people think, I think that even Jacob Rees-Mogg thinks he's being kind. So you can't just say be kind, because it doesn't actually mean anything. It means different things to different people.
Absolutely. And I suppose one of the only sort of solutions, like when you've not got the power to kind of change what these people are doing, is to get angry about it and to get riled
exactly.
up, you know?
Exactly. Sometimes it's be kind, and sometimes it's like get angry because you need to make change, and it's not even change about you. To be kind to like a whole group of marginalized people, they need you to act. They need you to get angry, and they need you to get active.
Yeah.
And just this idea of be kind is what does that even mean?
I heard you talk about one of the other ones in the book that wasn't to your liking, which was the phrase that I know that's similar to it is we says what's for you won't go by you.
Yeah.
And I think it was something like pass you by in your book or something. But
yeah.
What was your feelings towards that phrase?
That's a phrase that versions of it, like you say, slightly paraphrased, I've had to say it was written down by someone. And I then didn't know until, because obviously that happened a few years ago when I did the show, when I received that advice, I had heard it before. But then a few years later, in more recent years, like things in life that have happened that have been pretty tragic and harrowing, have had people say, oh, well, you know, and they've meant well, but they've said, yeah, well, what's for you won't pass you, or it was all meant to happen and things work out for a reason and it was always meant to be that way. And I don't subscribe to that at all when it comes to loss and bereavement and things like that. I think that it's not a comfort to say that that was how it was always meant to be, because yeah, that's just not true. Just bad, really, really shit things happen and there's not a rhyme or a reason behind it. And I don't think it's a comfort to say that there is.
Yeah, and I think that's it. It's meant to be a kind of comfort, isn't it? But ultimately, it's, you know, you're probably better to just deal with the reality that, as you say, like, bad things are going to happen and there's not really any rhyme or reason for it. But yeah, we have all these wee phrases, don't we, that kind of is meant to get you by, but it's like, yeah, if you kind of hold them under any scrutiny, then it's like, I'm not really sure if that holds up, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, of course, like, I always, you take these things in the spirit in which they're said in the moment, and I would never, like, I'd never, like, turn on someone for saying these things in the moment, because you can read what they're trying to say. They're trying to be kind, exactly. They're trying to be kind. So if you can feel people's kindness, that's more important than what their words are. But I do think, you know, in writing the book, I had to be like, no, that's not always as helpful as you think it is.
Now, I know that 2018 was quite a big year for you, year wise and just in general. Now, you've probably, I don't know if you remember this, but so Stephen, who's one of the other hosts, Stephen Buchanan, he won the BBC New Comedy Award in 2018. And you
I judged him.
I think you were the judge.
Yeah, he was amazing. It's so funny because, yeah, he was like, he was brilliant. Like, he stood out like as so good in that competition. And then I sort of didn't think about him for a couple of years, and then now he's cropping up all over social media, and I'm like sending my husband videos of him and his like taco kit sketch and everything that I love, dude. And the WH Smiths in airports.
That's he's now just honestly, the WH so Smith funny. Guy is what we always dig him up about.
Yeah.
No, because that was, I remember, because we were sharing a flat that year at the Fringe, and I remember, like, I didn't even get to go to the show. In fact, I think we were both on the Free Fringe and I was filling in for his slot because he was going to the final. So I was like, after that, I was like listening on the radio on my walk home at the flat, and then like listening to the fucking Archers and then waiting for the results. And then I was like, yes, like, it was brilliant. But yeah, unfortunately, the problem is Stephen's now got too big for his boots, which is why he's spotty. Doesn't he bother showing up today?
Unbelievable. So rude. What an arsehole.
No, I think he's actually currently in a meeting with some TV producers. So.
Ooh.
There you go. That's because he is too big for his boots. but I mentioned that to say, obviously 2018. So is that when things started kind of like sort of really blowing up in terms of like, is that when the MASH report was first starting to go viral and all that kind of thing?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So like, I've been working in comedy very happily and consistently, just a gigging comedian. I've got little bits of telework, sort of character actor stuff. Comedy actor stuff. And then, the MASH report basically went mad in January, February 2018, in a way that no one saw coming, including the entire BBC. Like, it was one of those clips was the most viral clip the BBC had ever had in its history. And they themselves were a bit like, we don't know what to do. We didn't expect this. It was mad. It was mad. And it was mad to kind of be suddenly viral for something that wasn't what I've been doing. Or what I've continued to do. Like, I love doing the MASH report. I really enjoyed getting stuck into like meaty topics and finding comedy in difficult to talk about political subjects. But that isn't what my live shows are, or what they were, or what they have been since. Like, I do a little bit of satire, certainly. I'll be singing Candle in the Wind about Liz Truss in this next tour. But but like, that's only a little bit of what my shows are now. So it was weird to like be suddenly known so much for that one thing.
Yeah, and yeah, what was that experience like? Is that, I mean, it was massive, and like those clips were particularly where it's obviously you're doing those segments, and you're really being dead harsh with Nish and all that kind of stuff. Like, it was brilliant, but it must have been quite, yeah, like a whirlwind. And I can imagine that. I don't know whether or not that was after your take on Be Kind, but I assume, you know, obviously just knowing the nature of internet comments that not everyone's going to be that, I suppose.
Yeah, you know what? Like, I feel more philosophical about it than I used to because I kind of understand, with some exceptions, like some people went obviously too far. There were people like messaging me on Facebook, wishing me cancer and stuff like
Oh
that,
my
which
God.
was too much. But it was such an angry time. And I think we're still there. But I don't think now, even with the Conservatives being as shit as they've been the last few years, I think probably because we all know the general election is around the corner, there's a bit of a feeling of a hope of change. And I think even people who don't want that change aren't perhaps as angry as they were around 2016 and 2020. I feel like we hadn't had that kind of leveling time of COVID where everyone had something else to concentrate on that was so universal. And everything was so binary, so angry, so divided. And those Mashable clips happened in that time. So I kind of get it. I was doing stuff that was divisive. It wasn't, I don't think it was, didn't feel controversial at all
Yeah.
to me or to the writer, to the co-writers. But actually, you know, in the time of Brexit, when it was so, everyone was so angry on both sides, that of course, you've got half the country being livid at you. So yeah, there was a lot of angry comments, but I get why. And
Yeah,
they didn't think, I
absolutely.
would just say in terms of the be kind thing, they would think that I wasn't kind. I had people saying that, saying you're not being kind to Boris Johnson. I was going like, please stop calling me a cunt on Twitter. But they were like, but you're not being kind to Boris Johnson. And I'd be like, I disagree. But like, they'd be like, you're not being kind to Brexit voters. You're not being kind to these people. So that's what I mean. Kindness is totally subjective. They don't think of me as a sympathetic figure. They think of me as an agitator. Whereas I think that what I was saying was purely truth and common sense that
And
they didn't.
what is the conservative values, if not be cruel to be kind? It's like pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Oh, don't be nice to people, because then they'll just, you know, sponge off and all that. That's their whole idea. So maybe, you know, you just be like,
It's
ah, well.
unbelievable they can't hear themselves. What at the moment, like James Cleverly, I saw this week saying, "Yay, we've succeeded in making sure that overseas care workers can't bring their dependent family members over with them." And it's like you're actually boasting about that. Can you hear yourself? Can you
Right.
actually hear yourself out loud? And I know that they would say, "You don't care about overcrowding in this country. You don't care about the housing crisis. You don't care." And I understand it's not simple, and that we do need to find solutions to that. But that's not one. That's a terrible one. Like, that's not one that you, even if that's one you quietly slip under the carpet and you're a bit ashamed of, that's not one you boast about from the rooftops.
Absolutely. And I think it's like they're just playing into that whole culture war thing from obviously that other end, because that's really the kind of last straw they've got left to try and get people to,
Yeah, that'll
you
actually
know.
like win them votes from some sides of, yeah, the conservative spectrum, won't it?
Just before we move on for that as well, because you were saying about it being like sort of a more contentious time, but obviously what happened with the MASH reports that then went to Dave, get rebranded as Late Night MASH, and then once Nish left, you were the host.
Yeah.
But from what I've seen, you were the host while all that Liz Truss stuff was going on.
And the Queen died.
Oh my God.
That was our series. That was our series. Like, it was my one crack at hosting a satirical show. It was 8 weeks long. And in those 8 weeks coincided precisely with the Liz Truss administration. So Liz Truss got into power. She did the mini budget with Kwasi Kwarteng, which obviously ruined the country. Then the Queen died. We got taken off air because the Queen died. We
Oh.
came back. The markets had crashed. The pound had tanked. And then it's the end of the series. And then she resigned. She resigned the day that was the last episode of that series.
Oh my
And we
God.
had, honestly, we had like producers going like, "Oh, can we talk a little bit less about party politics?" And I was like, "No, we fucking can't. Look what's happening. The country's in turmoil." It was absolutely bonkers time to do a series. I wish they'd given me another crack at it because My God, it was good. It was good to get stuck in. Also, we had an episode ready to go for the Queen dying.
Oh, really?
That was, it was good. It should have passed the test, but they decided to. They put, I think they pulled nearly all comedy shows off air that week just for fear of them saying something controversial.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, talk about a contentious issue. You can imagine the backlash of that. So did Liz Truss resign the day, like, did you just have time to address that in that
We
last
had to
episode sort
re-record
of
it,
thing?
so we'd recorded the episode, and then they called us up that so we'd recorded it the night before it airs, and then they were in touch with us that day to do
Yeah.
re-record. So we had to do like audio. We couldn't get the studio, but we had to do audio re-records. We even had like bits across the bottom of the screen to say like in the last 20, this has happened, adding in like audio. We did like a freeze screen. And then me going like a sort of, I know what you're thinking, audio
Oh
over the top.
my God, it's so stressful. You've got a there's a panel shown in BBC Scotland called Breaking the News, and
Yeah, I've
I
done Breaking the News. I love it. Yeah.
the 2 times I've done it in a row, the Prime Minister resigned. It was
Oh my
Boris resigned,
God.
and I was walking to the recording, watching his resignation from Down Street, and then the second time was the day that Liz Truss resigned, and I think that happened midway through the episode, and
Whoa.
it's like. It was, you're like, how do you prepare for this? Like,
In a way,
yeah.
it's quite good because you can't, so you have to actually be off the cuff, which is quite,
Yeah.
it's nice when like everyone has to be off the cuff instead of you're
Absolutely.
like just you haven't prepared, which is sometimes where I find myself.
You ended up getting on a lot of other tele shows off the back of kind of viral success and stuff like that. And so you ended up doing like obviously Live at the Apollo and Mock the Week and Would I Lie to You and stuff. Now, because from that description, right, that sounds like the sort of thing that, like, you know, if you were to make a movie about a comedian making it these days, it would be like viral clips, and then you end up on all the big shows. And but it must have been, I can imagine, overwhelming. And I'd just like to hear a wee bit about what it was like for you. First of all, to kind of go on those shows if you'd not like done like you know them before. Like, you know, it's been an interesting experience for any comic the first time they do that those kind of mainstream big shows in the telly. And
Yeah.
what was the reality of that like?
It was a lot all at once. And I would say I was so, I look back and watch myself and I'm like, I can see that I am not properly awake on some of them. I think I wish I'd had, yeah, I wish I could go back and do some of them again because some of them have not
Yeah.
had me back. And I don't blame them. You look
Oh,
at, like, I think I was absolutely in, I was still filming the MASH report. I was going on a sold out tour. I was doing so many PR interviews and things about that in this same few months, as well as moving into a new home, having stepkids, having a new partner, like it, all that happened
sure.
in the few months. And it was such a mad time in my life that I can see visibly if you watch them, like I am not able to do those shows. I wish I could have done them like a year later or have another
Yeah.
crack at them now. Like, would I lie to you? I think I say 3 words during the whole thing, and
Oh
none
my
of them are
God.
funny because I'm just like,
That would be impressive if you managed to get some funny, three funny
three
words.
very funny words. Yeah, and like Mock the Week, I always found quite hard. I do find panel shows generally quite difficult, but the main thing is I've got better at them. Like now, you know, I did the news quiz last week and I've done Breaking the News. Now I've got the hang of panel shows, but they, like any job, it's not the same as being a stand-up comedian where you're just given the spotlight, no one else is talking, you get to say what you want to say. You have to like grab time and have an incredible confidence in what you're saying. It's not in improv, you don't, you can just throw ideas and someone catches them and builds it with you. And it, panel shows I do not find are either like stand-up or improv. They're a weird in between that you have to learn as a skill how to do, and I hadn't learned that skill. So it was an amazing time. In a way, it was a bit like a boot camp of TV comedy.
Yeah.
But I hope I obviously I can't go back to Mock the Week now, but yeah, I hope I get to go back and do some of them again with a little bit more confidence and experience.
It's funny you say that, but I'm probably obviously which I know your background is in, but like it does seem as though I suppose it's the almost the like these panel shows are sometimes maybe the anti-improv because it's not yes and it's no but, and then someone putting in with their sort of thing, you know, or
Yeah,
cutting over you as opposed
sometimes
to that collective thing.
it's really bad. Do you know what? It's like there's certain things about the way they were created, who they were created by, and who for those panel shows that they don't suit everyone. Things like how well can you hear everyone and how well can they hear you? I would be like, on Mock the Week, they had a booster cushion for me, which helped, so that you're literally at the same height as the others. But they said that's actually the Josh Widdicombe cushion. But they also, like, I said to them, can you turn my mic up? Because I've got a really quiet voice. And they just couldn't hear me. And even looking back on some of the recordings, I can hear my little voice going, oh, yes, I thought that, but no one, and it's not that they're being like rude or boorish. Yeah. They just literally can't hear me. But that's sort of what panel shows are like, is what I've found.
Absolutely. And that's certainly the thing you always heard about Mock the Week, that it was certainly a bit more cutthroat and stuff like that.
Yeah, it got much better, I have to say.
Yeah.
It got much better. Like, I think even, you know, when you talk to Dara O'Brien about it, he's like, in the first few years, it was very punchy and kind of grabby. And then it did get much, much better. And it's like, and by the time I got on it, it was better. But I still found it hard.
And I've heard you speak about as well, like, the people's perception of you is kind of someone who's nice, you know, and which can be an interesting thing in comedy, because obviously one hand you want to be likable, but I suppose it also means that certainly I know myself, like, there's sometimes there'll be certain jokes over the years you try and you go, oh, do you know what, I just can't get away with that. Maybe someone else could, but it's not really, they're just not going to buy it for me. But then on the other hand, I think as well, you can contrast with that, I suppose. And is that something that you, like, certainly in the MASH report, I think it's a great example of you doing that and being very cutting with a smile, you know?
Yeah, there's a real mix, actually, because there is that kind of smiley persona, which helps, which means, yeah, I can get away with saying things and it doesn't come across as harsh. I've even noticed, like, when I've written for Radio 4 or for things for, particularly across radio stations, and they've got a policy on swearing, I've actually had, like, a note from, like, high up at the BBC going, somehow the way Rachel Paris is delivering this, it doesn't come across as a bad swear word. So we're going to let her say fuck this, because it's somehow, yeah, and that's sort of like, I would say that is like white privilege in a way. Like, that is such a thing of, like, she comes across as so kind of middle class white that somehow we're letting her say the really bad words because they don't feel threatening to the audience somehow. I don't know what it is, but, like, I feel like they'd more let me say fuck than let Fern Brady say fuck. Say,
aye, that's it. Try doing it with a Scottish accent. Mate.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like, you know, if a Glaswegian's saying fuck at you, it is on the airwaves, you know.
In fact, sometimes they don't let us say words that aren't even swear words, to be honest.
Yeah, they're like, I'm sorry, it just sounds threatening. So, like, yeah, there is sort of the nice persona. But on the other hand, I think since the MASH report, there's also an expectation of political punch, which is a different thing that I can't live up to. Like, I'm not that nice, and I'm also not that political punchy. That's something I did for the MASH report, and I put a bit of it in live shows. Obviously, I do still have political opinions, and I still write a bit of comedy on it, but my live shows are not an hour-long MASH report piece. Like, it's much lighter. It's a lot less opinionated. It's more like relatable observational comedy, to be honest.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, we talk about this a lot on our podcast, because as you mentioned earlier on with Stephen, like, so he done all these videos and stuff like that. And I think whenever you have some sort of success online, or just in general, if whatever thing becomes popular for you, you worry that, oh my God, is the audience going to expect, like, the whole show to be like this? But I think as long as you know in yourself that, you know, you do stand up and, you know, you're confident the show's funny and all of that, and you go, even if they're coming along maybe with certain expectations, you know, they'll like what the show is. So
that's exactly what's happened. So, like, even the first tour that I did after the MASH report, that was only like 2 months after going viral in 2018, I know, like, definitely no doubt statistically, it was very clear that those ticket sales were from people who watched the MASH report and had bought tickets to see me do that on tour. But that show was not that much like the MASH report. It was sort of almost a best of my stand-up and musical comedy. So they were not expecting any songs. and they were expecting pure political Tory slagging off, like kind of match report stuff. And what they got was so different. But I, as far as I felt from their reaction and from messages from them and everything, they were happy. They were happy. They were like, oh my God, she's also going to sing and play piano. What? And she's going to talk about other stuff other than politics. So I feel like I'm no longer kind of worried that people might turn up for punchy politics and what they might get is a song about my toddler.
Was there ever a temptation to just sort of do that? Did you ever think, maybe I should just do a whole show and just be like the news person kind of for an hour?
I don't think I could, you know, like I'd find it so exhausting to do. It's one thing doing it week after week for like 8 weeks of a year or sometimes more, but like to do that night after night on tour, it's just not me. I've always done stand-up that's just like who I am and what my life is, and to do it for a TV job, that's fine in 5-minute segments, but I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that. I feel happiest when I'm basically sort of bearing my soul a bit for the audience.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? You've just got to be kind of authentic to what you feel comfortable doing and what you like to do as well. So this is what the new tour is very much about, Poise, 1st of May, Oranmore in Glasgow. Are you doing Edinburgh as well while you're up? Or...
haven't got any dates in Edinburgh yet, but we're looking at the Fringe, maybe doing a date at the Fringe, but we haven't
Excellent.
Found out yet.
And so what can people expect from this new show then?
Essentially, it's a show about womanhood and how different that can look to different people. For me, it's about turning 40, finding myself in a much more traditional place than I ever thought that I would be as a wife and a mum to a toddler and a stepmum to teenagers, having a house, which is something that I never dreamed that I would have as a geriatric millennial. Who ever thinks, you know, I only ever knew one person in my friendship group who owned a property and I married them. So
that's smart thinking, to be
smart,
fair.
Right? I'm no fool. So like, it's kind of, I've literally done a show in the past called Best Laid Plans that was about never having any of those things. It was about me coming to terms with having a life that was so different from my parents' generation. I literally in that show drew on a chalkboard a picture of a house and a car and a dog and a kid and crossed it out. And the whole point of the show was reclaiming this idea of I don't need the trappings of that kind of life. And I'm turning 40 now and I have all those things. And so the comedy is about the mess of my life, about all of those things that will be relatable to some people and not at all relatable to other people, because everyone's
it's
different.
Aspirational to someone
else.
But
it's not, but it shouldn't be aspirational. Why aspire to that just because it's not like it, you know, and people who have those things aspire to singledom, they aspire to the freedom, they aspire to having a lion in the morning, they aspire to traveling the world without any ties. So it's not aspirational at all. It's about how life can look any way that you want it to, but I find the comedy obviously in my own life and the absolute mess of it.
I'm speaking basically from personal experience. I'm like, that sounds like, you know, that'd be nice to get to the point of achieving it.
The house though. Yeah, the house, like there's no question, like obviously owning that, like that is aspirational. Having a house is aspirational. Look at me, I've got wardrobes behind me. I mean, come on.
That's a nice flex right there. And you mentioned your partner, obviously, Marcus Bigstock, who is a comic as well. Now, here's the thing, right? Because I'm, like, obviously, I've been doing comedy for a while, right? And so you hear a lot of comics, right? And they always say stuff like, I think sometimes protesting a wee bit too much about this whole, I could never date another comic and I could never go with another comic. But for me, I always think it would maybe make sense to end up with someone that's at least in the industry, because it's such weird... What it's a weird lifestyle, it's the weird hours, it's hard. Like if someone's a teacher or does 9 to 5 or whatever, it's be difficult. Whereas at least someone, you know, if they're in the industry, there must be a lot of nice positives to that. But I can also imagine it's probably a wee bit of, you know, it's like it's, maybe I don't know if it's a competitiveness or there's difficulties in that sense. How's it been for yous?
Yeah, like I can't really imagine forming a grown-up life with someone not in at least a similar industry, because it is so strange and disjointed. I mean, I suppose maybe life would be easier in a way if at least one of us had some routine, But at least we both totally understand, like, each week, especially if you've got kids, like each week we have to sit down and go, okay, how the hell are we making our life work this week? You're going to be in Lowestoft Tuesday afternoon to evening. I'm touring Bristol Thursday, Saturday, and then we've got podcast here and here, one of which we could do remotely, but one of which we've got to go into London. We're doing that together, and then we're moving. We've got the estate agent coming. Like, literally, it's a juggle, but I couldn't imagine doing that juggle with someone who had a 9 to 5, because they would be so frustrated and angry all the time, I think. So yeah, I mean, that whole like never date a comedian thing, like there's been a lot of talk about that, but I don't, obviously I don't agree around one, but I think part of what drew us to each other is a basic shared understanding of what our life looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think there's a lot to be said for that. And yeah, it's I always think as well, right? Because people always go like that, and then you're like, but you're a comic, so what do you think of yourself? If you're like, oh,
I
comics are
know.
all fucking crazy, but you're like, but you're one, so you can't even
Yeah,
be
yeah,
that
yeah. I also
bad.
think, and I think the idea about like, oh, I can't trust a comedian, you know, I know enough of them. And I think that's maybe an old-fashioned idea when fewer people were comedians. So you could judge what the traits of a comedian used to be easier, maybe. But now there are so many people are comedians now that. And there's so many different kind. There's room for so many different kinds of comedy, and therefore so many different kinds of comedian, that the idea of saying a comedian is like that or a comedian is like that doesn't really work anymore. Like, there are introverted comedians, there are extroverted comedians, there are organized, very organized comedians, and very disorganized comedians. So it doesn't have that same. I don't think the stereotypes work as well as they used to. They still do a bit, but not as well as they used to.
So if you're discounting who it dates, you need to be specific with the type of comedian
Exactly,
that
exactly. Just use some adjectives before you say comedian.
you don't. Don't date male comedians, probably a good start. No.
Yeah,
But listen, Rachel, I think we've taken up enough of your time here. Thank you so much for doing this. And
thank
so what
you.
once again, people can see it in Glasgow in the 1st of May at Oran Mór, and your tour starts again. Is it the, did you say it was the
It starts here 20th of April in Bristol. I'm also going to Aberdeen and Dundee if they're travelling around a
Nice.
bit.
Whereabouts are you playing there?
I'm doing the Whitehall Theatre in Dundee and the Tivoli in Aberdeen. So come and see me there.
Brilliant. Absolutely. We'll do check you out if you're in those cities. And well, thanks very much for joining us, Rachel. And best of luck with the tour. When
Thanks
we
so
catch you at some
much.
point meet up
Say
here.
hi to
But
Stephen for me as well.
I will do, yes. I will pass on your kind regards. And it's just good to know that another person just knows him as a WH Smith guy, which is always funny.